So, with our passage today, we finally meet the protagonist, right? Last week we talked about the king and his queen, but no mention of the protagonist, the lady who the book's named after, right? There's only two books in the whole Bible where we have a woman who is the title of the book. And so we finally meet her in this chapter. But let me ask you a question before we get started. What happens if you are a religious minority living in a time where the culture is dominated with completely different ideas than what you believe? So let me say that again. What happens if you're a religious minority living in a time where the culture is dominated with completely different ideas than what you believe? This is the situation God's people find themselves in the book of Esther. This is where Esther finds herself facing. Remember that the Jews are the minority in Persia. They have no king, no land, no army, nothing of their own. Somebody else is ruling them. We will soon find in the next chapter that God's people are in trouble, which is not news for a reader of the Bible because God's people are always in trouble in the Old Testament. So it shouldn't be too much of a shock, but God had sent signs, wonders, miracles, prophets to help in that time. But as Becky said last week, there is no mention of God at all in the book of Esther. There's no vision. There's no dream. There's no prophecy. There's not even a prayer. And so for the Christian woman, that should be alarming, right? But don't fear, because God is everywhere in the book of Esther. It's almost as if he designed himself to look so absent so you would see him more. But this unseen God is working. He is seen in the providence of the book. The unseen God is working through human history in completely regular everyday events. So before we get to our passage, I just want to talk a little bit about providence. And I have on the bottom a definition of providence, but let me just read you what John Piper said. And I read what he said, and I'm like, I can't do any better. He gave a great illustration, so I'm just going to read his words. There is a reason why seeing to means providing for. Remember the story of Abraham sacrificing Isaac, his son. Before they went up the mountain, Isaac said to his father, "Where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" in Genesis 22:7. Abraham answered, "God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son." And when God had shown Abraham the ram caught in the thorns in Genesis 22:14, the text says, Abraham called on the name of the place, "The Lord will provide." Whenever it says provide in Genesis 22, the Hebrew word is see. Very simply, Abraham said to Isaac, "God will see to for himself the lamb." And in verse 14, instead of calling the place "the Lord will provide," it could be called "the Lord will see." God never simply sees without acting. He is God. He is not a passive participant in the world that exists without his sustaining it. Whenever God is looking, God is acting. If God perceives, he performs. In other words, there is a profound theological reason why providence does not merely mean foreknowledge, but rather the active sustenance and governance of the universe. When God sees, he sees too. His seeing is always with a view of doing. At the end of Exodus 2, we realized that, right? When we studied the Israelites in slavery, and when their burden got so great, they cried out to the Lord. At the end of chapter 2, it says, "And God knew." Now, he didn't forget, right? We had a whole lesson on that. It's this active knowledge. It was time to act on it. It was the right time for him to intercede. And so all narratives have providence in it. So you might go, "Courtney, why are you talking about providence? Every narrative has providence." But it's important for us to see the providence specifically in this book, this chapter of Esther, because there's a lot of awful things happening to a young woman. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem like God is there, but he is. Mm-hmm. And so as a woman reading this, as a woman with daughters reading this, as a woman with granddaughters, this is a hard chapter to digest. But God is working. So, I looked at our New City Catechism that we do on Family Discipleship Nights, but they didn't actually have a question on providence. So I went to the Westminster Catechism, and the 18th Catechism question is, what are God's works of providence? And that's what I have on the board right there. God's works of providence are his most holy, wise, and powerful preserving and governing of all creatures, ordering them and their actions to his own glory. And so, ladies, I would submit to you today, and hopefully that you will see, that this chapter 2 of Esther is about God's providence. God orders events to orchestrate his plan to make a captive a queen. That's my theme on the board right there. So let's read the text and dive into the lesson. Long introduction. After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus was abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's young men who attended him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces to his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem of Susa, the capital, under custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who's in charge of the women. Let their cosmetics be given to them, and let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." This pleased the king, and he did so. Now there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, and she had neither father nor mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. And when her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and many young women were gathered in Susa the citadel in custody of Haggai, Esther was also taken to the king's palace and put in custody of Haggai, who had charge of the women. And the young woman pleased him and won his favor, and he quickly provided for her with her cosmetics, her portion of food, and with 7 chosen young women from the king's palace, and advanced her and her young woman to the best place in the harem. Esther had not made known her people or her kindred, for Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. And every day Mordecai walked in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and what was happening to her. Now when the turn came for each young woman to go to King Ahasuerus, after being 12 months under the regulations for women, since this is the regular period of their beautifying, 6 months with oil and myrrh, 6 months with spices and ointments for women, when the young woman went to the king in the way, she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening she would go in, and in the morning she would return to the second harem in custody of Shahazagaz, a king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would not go to the king again, unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. When the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who was taken her as his own daughter, to go into the king, she asked for nothing except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who had charge of the women, advised. Now Esther was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her. And when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus and to his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a great feast for all his officials and servants. It was Esther's feast. He also granted a remission of taxes to the provinces and gave gifts with royal generosity. So we see here in verses 1 through 4, how earthly powers seek to please themselves. Between the end of chapter 1 and the beginning of chapter 2, 4 years have gone by. We know that because of some of the language in the verses near the end of the chapter. 4 years since the extravagant feast and partying that happened in chapter 1. 4 years since the edict of banishing Vashti as queen. During this time, King Ahasuerus went to war with Greece. And he was unsuccessful. He came back defeated. It was a very famous battle, so much so because the favor was in Ahasuerus' side because of his numbers. I mean, there's movies and books and all sorts of things written on it. But it was a very famous battle because he lost so bad when he should have won. people who don't even know the Bible know of this battle. So, anyways, so this famous battle was humiliating, this defeat. His treasures of the Persian Empire were depleted, and his subjects thought less of their king because of this defeat. This same king who was introduced to us in chapter 1, showing off his power and wealth, was now home from battle, disgraced. And the text says in verse 1 that his anger was gone and that he remembered Vashti. If you remember from last week, Vashti was refused to go to the king, and out of his passionate anger, and he listened to people who stroked his ego, he made an edict to banish Vashti and because she wouldn't see the king. But in his punishing of her, he punished himself, because this law was irreversible. So if he changed his mind, he couldn't get her back. And how many times do humans, us sinners, everyone, say something out of anger that they shouldn't be doing? This is like normal stuff. It's awful what he did, but I mean, our emotions can rule us. And how many times do we regret what's come out of our mouths? But praise the Lord that there's grace and God forgives. But sometimes there's a bruising that's left. But this bruising, nothing could be done about it. And so he punished himself when he punished her. And now in chapter 2, this defeated king has no queen. And he starts listening again to the counsel of people who shouldn't be giving him advice. Last time, weren't they like kings of other regions or something? This time, they're just young men, okay? Now, do you want your husband to get advice from 18-year-old boys? I mean, like, I love how it's like young men. It's not just some guys. But so they decide to cheat King Ahasuerus up by suggesting, I'm calling it a beauty pageant, but it's way more demeaning than that. But, you know, bring the young virgins. Let's see them, right? I mean, that's what a young man would think, how he would think. Young virgins were to be found throughout all of the empire to be brought to him. They were to be pampered and prepared for him, cosmetics and all the like, and whoever pleased him the most could replace Vashti as queen. And the king was pleased and delighted with this suggestion, and he made it happen. The king is acting no different than he did in chapter 1. He's all about himself. He's all about his pleasure. He's still listening to bad counsel. Proverbs 21:1 states, the king's heart is a stream of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he will. The unseen God is working. God is seeing to. He is ordering events to orchestrate his plan to make a captive a queen. So we see in our I broke it up into three sections. Our second section of our narrative is verses 5 through 15. In the midst of all this vast exploitation of one particular young woman is shown unexpected, lavish favor. So here in verses 5 through 7, we have a pause from the king and his plans. The flow of the story is interrupted by the introduction of Esther through her cousin Mordecai. I think it's very funny. Jeff always thought Mordecai was her uncle until he started doing this. And I'm like, I might have thought that too. So it might have been because VeggieTales taught me that. I don't know. But... like, how many times I want to call him Morty is awful. But anyways, I'm like, Bill Connell will be up here calling him Morty for sure. But so there's this break in the story to learn about two people. Out of our 18 verses, there are three verses dedicated to this. And that's pretty important. So these verses are important to the ensuing story, not just this chapter, but for the whole book. Mordecai is described as a man of the Jews. We get a little genealogy of his, which helps us to set up the story in the wider context of Jewish history. Mordecai is the son of Jar, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjamite. And sometimes when we read genealogies, we're like, yeah, I know they're important, but you just want to keep going with the text. But this is so important for the rest of the story. It associates Mordecai with King Saul. For if you go back to 2 Samuel 16, verses 5 through 8, it says that Shimei was a member of Saul's clan, Kish was Saul's father, and Saul belonged to the tribe of Benjamin. So again, all this information is for us to tuck away and will become more significant as the book of Esther unfolds. But it isn't just significant for later, it's also significant for now, because we are introduced to God's people. Finally, in the story of Esther, we learn of God's people. Mordecai and Esther are part of God's covenant family. It's even more emphasized that they are God's people by mentioning exile. In these three verses, they talk about two other kings in exile. Those kings aren't even around, but it's so important for you to see that this is God's people group, and remember, they're in exile. God carried people away from Jerusalem. More historical context to understand the events that will transpire and to show association with Mordecai and his ancestors. This is divine providence, positioning God's people where they are for his purpose. Esther is introduced as a young woman with a beautiful figure and lovely to look at. I think there's one other instance in Song of Solomon where a woman is described in such a way. So for you to see all those words to describe one woman, that's very significant. If you're studying, pay attention to the words, right? We also find out in verse 7 that she's in a dependent relationship with Mordecai. Mordecai has adopted her. And we know from history that a young woman on her own is worthless and it will die and be taken advantage of, right? But Mordecai has adopted her and put her under his care. This information helps us to see that Esther is expected to behave in a submissive obedience to Mordecai. He's in charge of her. He has his best interest for her, and she will listen to him. When we also see this specifically in verse 10 when Mordecai instructs her not to say who she is about her heritage, and she listens to him, keeping her identity as a Jew to herself. Throughout the book of Esther, you will see this theme, not only of feasts, but of identity. Here we see identity being hidden. It's God's purpose or providence for this identity to be hidden right now. Verse 8 now takes us back to the king. It's unsure how many girls were brought to the king. We do know that it was a lot, for the search went through all of his provinces. 127, is that right? If you look in your booklet, there's a map that shows you how huge Ahasuerus' reign went. And he was gathering young virgins from all of it, not just Persian provinces. So the likelihood of not getting a Persian seems high if you like start going down that trail, but he wasn't just grabbing Persian women to be queen. Go back to my notes. So throughout the book of Esther, you'll see this theme of identity. Here the identity is hidden. And now Esther, the king goes back to his search, sorry. We see in the language of verse 8, look at the verbs. It's very important. We see the women were gathered, and that Esther was also taken. We aren't told they had a choice, but the language makes it so we think the opposite, that they were forced. This is not a happy experience for most of the girls to be taken away from what they know and who they know. We find in verse 8 that Esther is among the chosen. But the unseen God is working. He is seeing to. He is orchestrating. He's ordering events to orchestrate his plan to make a captive a queen. They're taken to the palace and put under charge of a eunuch, Haggai. It's here we see that Esther is gaining favor. This is a theme for the book of chapter 2 of Esther, this gaining favor. This gaining favor is also a clue of God's presence. Haggai is pleased with her, and he ensures her access to the beauty treatments, to food. He gives her 7 palace servants and places her to the best part of the harem. I have no idea what the best part of the harem is, but he makes it so she gets there because he finds favor with her. Esther neither sought entry or advancement in this harem. Rather, it was just given to her. This favor of God's providential care and leading of Esther. The unseen God is working. God is seeing to. He is ordering events to orchestrate his plan to make a captive a queen. We also see Mordecai in verse 11 pacing in front of the court of the harem wanting to learn about Esther. And here we have a contrast of the two main men of the story, Mordecai and the king. You have Mordecai, who is in charge of a woman and he cares about her. He goes to the gate to learn about her. He has compassion for her. He's reflecting God's compassion for the weak in this moment, as opposed to the king, who has many young women under his care in all the provinces he reigns over. And he doesn't care about them. He rips them out of their homes. He's all about himself and his pleasure. That's his motivation. So we have a huge contrast between the two men. The narrative returns to life in the harem in verse 12. There is a general description of the process followed by each girl. They each received full 12-month beauty program made up of 6 months of oil and myrrh, 6 months of cosmetic treatments. The preparation for one night with the king is extravagant in length and luxury. Before their night with the king, the woman could take whatever they wanted with them in their attempt to please the king. It was a night in which much depended, because if they didn't please him, then all that remained for them was the life of a concubine trapped in the palace in another harem, waiting. No guarantee the king would ever call them again, so many were confined to a virtual widowhood, which you know is also a dangerous thing for women back in those days. So again, more contrast of a king not caring, a king self-absorbed. Again, we see the king using so many other human beings just to satisfy his personal desires. His abuse of power is evident in the demise of so many young women for his physical pleasure. In verse 15, it's Esther's turn. Again, we're reminded of who she is and where she is from. Verse 15 mentions Esther being the daughter of Abihail, who is the uncle of Mordecai, and how Mordecai has adopted Esther as his own. We already knew this stuff, but the author is like, this is so important, I'm mentioning again before she sees the king, which is like the climax of the book, right? Of the chapter, I keep saying the book. So it's really important that we see her identity is being set again, how Mordecai has adopted Esther as his own. It's this highlighting of identity and who God's covenant people are. She listens to the advice of Haggai, which was wise since he would know more about what the king would like, which is a contrast of listening to good advice where the king listened to bad advice, more contrast. And right before she sees the king, the author again mentions how Esther has gained favor. At the end of verse 15, Esther was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her. This has been the rising tension building, right? All of this tension is building on desire for a new queen, the capture of Esther, gaining favor from the eunuch, advancing, Mordecai's instruction to hide her identity, all the beauty preparation, gaining favor. All this rising tension is building and building. Who will be queen? Will Esther be queen? And you're like, I already know she's going to be queen because I know the story. But if you've not read the story before, you don't know. And so it's the rising tension, right? Will it be Esther? It's God's purpose or God's providence for Esther to gain favor in the sight of all. The unseen God is working. God is seeing to. He is ordering events to orchestrate his plan to make a captive a queen. Now we get to our last section, verses 16 through 18. God puts Esther in a place of blessing that will bring blessing to the world. In verse 16 and 17, it doesn't talk about Esther's night with the king. There's no details. It just states that he loves her more than the others. She won grace and favor. This is consistent with what we've already read about Esther. She found favor in all the events she went through. This favor is virtually important, a clue to God's presence in the story. And we mentioned it in our table discussion, but how can you not think of Joseph? In chapter 39, the Lord is with Joseph, and he finds favor in the sight of Potiphar. He's successful. And it says the Lord is with Joseph and finds favor. And then later on in the chapter, the Lord is with Joseph. Let me get the right words. Also in the same chapter, the Lord was with Joseph and gave him favor in the sight of the jail keeper. And so, I mean, it's beautiful because we just studied Joseph. But the reader goes, God is here. All this favor. That means God is planning. God is with him. God is active in the story of Esther. God placed Esther in the palace for a purpose. King Ahasuerus makes Esther his queen and throws a feast in her name. What a contrast to Vashti's feast. Queen Vashti threw a feast for women and refused to come see the king wearing her crown. And now the king crowns Esther and throws a feast for her. And so this feast theme you're supposed to look at, and you're supposed to compare them. What is God doing? How is God changing the characters? How is he reversing them? What is he doing? So that's good for you to look at when you're studying the book more as we go on. But the king was so focused on himself in the first chapter with feasting. And now, because of Esther, he throws a feast in her name. He gives out gifts. He gives a remission of, you know, the taxes. It's totally opposite. Who is this guy? This isn't the king we know. He has completely changed. This is totally not what we're used to. There's a reversal here of, there's a lot of reversals here, but one is the change in the king. And because of Esther, all sorts of people are being blessed. Because Esther pleased the king throws blessing on all of his provinces with the gifts and the remission of taxes, which should make us think of the covenant God made with Abraham. I will bless those who bless you, right? And the world will find blessing through you. So, you know your Old Testament. All sorts of things start popping up when you read Esther. So this unseen God is here. He is so here. He is everywhere. If we look at Acts 2, verses 22 through 24, men of Israel, hear the words, Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested to you. This is Peter speaking, I'm sorry. Men of Israel, hear these words, Jesus of Nazareth, the man attested to you by God with mighty works and wonders and signs that God did through him in your midst. As yourselves know, this Jesus, delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men. God raised him up, losing the pangs of death because it was not possible for him to be held by it. According to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, it says in Acts. Although wicked men had their own plan to put Jesus to death, their actions were within the sovereign determination of God. God needed to put Christ on the cross in order for us to live with him, in order for us to be saved. That was the plan all along. But the men who put him on the cross made their own decisions. They had wicked intentions, but God used that. Just like Joseph, we studied. The brothers had evil intentions for Joseph, but God had a plan, because through Joseph, the world would be saved. And Esther is no different. Here in our story, we have a king with selfish pleasure-seeking decisions affecting the lives of young women. One of those decisions makes Esther become queen, but God also wanted Esther to be queen. This unseen God is working. God is seeing too. He is ordering events to orchestrate his plan to make a captive Esther a queen. So back to the question I asked you in the beginning. What happens if you're the religious minority living in a time where the culture is dominated with completely different ideas than what you believe? You should have thought, that's me, when I said that. It isn't just Esther. We are no different. God's people from the past are no different than God's time now. Now, we know way more than Esther did and Mordecai did. Praise the Lord. But because of our knowledge, we have more responsibility. We know more. We see what's going on. And so the narrative doesn't say God's people are going to avoid pain and suffering. Oh no, Christian, you know that isn't true. We are guaranteed there will be suffering in this sinful body we live in, with sinful people we dwell with, in a fallen world. There will be suffering. But the text does tell us, in the bleak situation, God is providential and he cares and he's operating. In the events of life, when it appears God is absent, he is not. And that is so important for us to know. Because we have weak moments, and we need our church family, hopefully your husband or a sister, to remind you of these things. Your pastor needs to be reminded of these things. You might think, oh, he knows all this stuff. He is a weak man like all of us. We all need reminding how God is working, because we have moments where it's hard, and it's hard to see. And so one of our responsibilities to each other is to point it out and to love each other. God is omnipresent. God isn't just present in the big events, like the parting of the Red Sea we just learned about. Or God isn't just with you in your conversion when you became a Christian. He's always with you. He was with you when you were putting lipstick on this morning, when you were rushing your family out the door. He is always there. And oh, do we forget? Because if we always thought that, we would never sin. We forget he's there. It's true. This is so applicable to all of us. But be encouraged, because he's with us in these everyday moments, which means he's taking care of us. He's planning. He's working. He's orchestrating events. If you think about it, our Lord Jesus Christ was a captive. He was captured and he was put to death. But when he raised from the dead, he didn't stay here. He ascended to heaven and is seated on the throne. He's not a queen. He's a king. So our Christ was a captive made into royalty. And so Esther just points to that. And oh, that will be us. If you believe in Christ, when we die, we will be ascended and sit on the throne next to worshiping our God. And so we are Esther as well. Our situations are a little different, but chapter 2 seems like a dark chapter at first. Oh, is it filled with hope, because God is there. So let's go back to this Providence Catechism question. What are God's works of providence? The answer is, God's works of providence are his most holy, wise, and powerful preserving and governing of all his creatures, ordering them and their actions to his own glory. So why should we study this? What good will it do? That we may be patient in adversity, thankful in prosperity, and for what the future, and for what is in the future, have good confidence in our faithful God and Father, that no creature shall separate us from his love, since all creatures are so in his hand, and without his will, they cannot do as much as move. So that is chapter 2. And Kendra, I hope it's a better chapter than what you thought of when you first came. She sat down at the table and she went, "Wow, this chapter." And I'm like, "Good, you should think that. It's awful. But it's also hopeful." And so walk away with hope and knowing that God is there and he is taking care of you in your struggles, in what you're suffering through right now. He is there and he loves you so much and he has a plan for you. But one of those plans is for you to be in his word, surrounded by believers who will encourage you and love you. So,
can I ask a question?
Sure, I hope I can answer it.
I think you can. You know, when they were gathering the women, is it some women's desire to be a queen? You know, like if you look in storybooks and things like that, you know.
Right, I know what you're saying. It's impossible for us to know all the minds. Depending on the type of life they had before they were gathered, maybe.
Yeah, but when you think he got rid of Vashti, they think the same thing can happen to me.
That's true, but like we don't know. We don't know their minds.
She wasn't obedient.
But they didn't have a choice. The verbs are gathered and taken.
I understand that.
And so, I think the author wants us to focus on there wasn't a choice. But I'm sure there's some who.
I was just curious,
didn't
some of
have
them
that.
Saw it as a privilege or status.
They could have, but that's, that's going past the text and not, who knows the motives
right.
of all
just
of them.
Curious.
But I'm sure, if there's hundreds of women who were gathered, not everyone's like-minded in a group of 400 or 500.
That's true, too.
What actually is a concubine?
Go ahead.
What actually is a concubine?
A lesser wife.
Is he still a wife? Is she how does that work? Are they taken care of through the king?
They're fed and clothed and taken care of, but they're used as a sexual item for him. So if they took 12 months just to get them nice for one night, I'm sure they still had a nice regimen to keep them nice if the king ever called them. But remember, in that time, to have children was the greatest thing ever. They would take care of you. So if their looks and whatever was fading in that second harem, they might not want, they might be cast out of it. So this is more going further and studying historical, but I mean, it was not a good thing. It was not something you desired.
Basti, I'm wondering, okay, what happened to Basti? Where did she go? How did she survive?
Doesn't say. Back in that time, if you were a woman, you were dependent on family members.
Right.
If you didn't have family who were willing to help you, mm-hmm. it was a bleak situation. So she might have had family members who didn't want to help her just because of the king. Who knows? But it. Yeah. You don't want to be a concubine at all. That is a desired thing. That's a negative thing. So, yes, Sherry.
With what Karen had asked in terms of, you know, we don't know the minds of the queen, but if you think of the concubine contrast with the queen, and you mentioned in terms of children, the children of the queen would have a much higher status. And so you think of, we were talking of the importance of the line and genealogies, and so while they might be afraid of being banished, they might be afraid of all of these different things, but there's the hope of their children having,
legitimacy,
mm-hmm.
Well, status. And also, him taking the young virgins, what about the young men of the villages or the provinces? There's no woman to marry. Well, there's no pretty women to
marry. I was just going
to
say,
but I mean, like,
the daughter's still available.
His selfish desires didn't just affect the women. It affected their families. It affected the province. It was just terrible.
It affected the women that weren't taken. Like...
Or not me! Thankfully, I'm ugly!
Thank you.
The pretty woman probably tried to hide when the kingsman came.
But you see the irony? He picked a woman basically living next door to him. Because Mordecai's at the gate. He didn't say travel, he was there.
Yeah.
Even in the ensuing story, like Mordecai's hanging, like that's where he lives. So it's like going on Match.com and finding your mate in the same zip code or something. You know? Oh, Misty, here's your bulletin. Sorry.
How are you doing?
I'm going to put out an album. The kids were so shocked. They wouldn't even come to the
I said that.